Friday. Sitting in the breakfast nook, I analyze the geography of our bodies. I realize that I lean toward my husband when he speaks to me. It's my body that moves, not his. I change position. I inch closer. I twist my neck. My husband keeps his back straight and looks ahead of him when he eats, while I am lopsided and unbalanced. I'm struck by this when we stand up to get more coffee. My husband's chair is perfectly centered. Mine, on the other hand, is turned to the left, toward my husband's. I am convinced that if I made a map of my daily micro-movements, it would reveal that my husband is the sun around which the majority of my movements gravitate. I greet him at the front door when he comes home at night. I sit next to him on the sofa. I go to him when he speaks to me from the kitchen and I'm in the living room. I change rooms for him. Because of him, I am always the last to leave the table. I turn off the lights. I follow him up the stairs. I move behind him, remaining in his shadow. My husband, on the other hand, is not influenced by my comings and goings. My gravitational force is never sufficiently powerful to make him deviate from his course. What physical forces decide our movement through space? What determines our speed and our strength? What is the physical formula? When I meet Lucie on Saturday mornings for tennis, our bodies meet halfway. I enter the club and see her seated in a chair near the entrance. She spots me, stands up, and heads toward me as I am walking toward her. We meet in the middle of the lobby, which seems to be a perfectly reasonable way of going about things. Why are the laws of physics that govern my movements with Lucie different from those with my husband? My children eat in silence, their gazes still sleepy and their pajamas wrinkled. The only sound is that of spoons and bowls, the regular clangs composing an agitating music. I watch as they eat their toast and whisper a few words to each other. Their chairs are so close, they might as well be glued together. I've always hated children who talk too loudly. The decibel level that is socially acceptable for children has always seemed excessive to me. Under the pretext that they're children, that their voices are not yet fully formed, they are allowed to speak more loudly than adults. But I've succeeded at one thing, at least, in my children's education. They both speak very softly. Even when they were little, my house never overflowed with screams. My husband informs me that he plans to swim after work tonight. Then he has a dinner with a former co-worker who's passing through town. I am cold, impassive. I won't reveal that I'm bothered, but I grab my phone, like a life preserver in the middle of a shipwreck, which I have once more left on the kitchen table. I promise to stop, but I have a harder and harder time sticking to my resolution, especially when my husband cruelly announces to me that he won't be spending the evening at home. Fortunately, today's breakfast is calm, so I can listen attentively to my husband's announcements, the pool, the dinner. I concentrate on his words so that I will feel less of a need to replay them later, to recreate the entire scene. In our bedroom, my husband's clothes are on the floor in a corner. His towel, still damp, is on the bed. I gather it and hang it up. I don't comment on all his things lying everywhere. I also don't say anything about the mess in the bathroom or the breakfast table he didn't clear, his dinners in town, his nights at the pool. Never any reproach of this kind. I refuse to succumb to such conventional arguments. Actually, we don't argue much at all. Maybe that's what we're missing. And yet, I adore conflict, broken dishes, slammed doors. I've always found tranquil partnerships uninteresting. Couples that don't ever argue come off as inferior, and I've always suspected they love each other less. But I've also always refused to engage in ordinary squabbles. That my husband doesn't do the dishes after dinner or doesn't know how to iron a shirt is annoying, but those are obstacles I can overcome. On the other hand, I don't know that I would be able to bear such a banal argument for such a trivial reason. If we argue, it must at least be a matter of jealousy or profound doubt, existential drama and painful soul-searching. I think it's essential that a couple's arguments always be about love. I half listen to the radio while wiping down the breakfast table, but I have a hard time waking up. I am still in the unreal state that persists when I emerge from sleep too quickly, and my dream superimposes itself onto the day. I dreamed again that my husband was a knight and I was his betrothed. My husband faced a series of challenges before he could reach me. Sword battles, dragons, duels, horse races, poetry contests, dangerous precipices. The events of the dream are always the same. My husband overcomes every obstacle in his path. He fights his competitors successfully. He's an unmatched knight and an unrivaled courtier. However, each victory triggers the beginning of the next trial. He continues relentlessly, succeeding at all of them, but ends up dying of exhaustion, a prisoner in a perpetual romantic tournament. Except that, for the first time, my dream didn't end that way. Last night, my husband survived. Once he understood that there was no possible victory, that it was a trap, he forfeited and left. I don't love this dream, but it's a recurring dream, and a recurring dream is not supposed to change. I serve myself another cup of coffee. My dream dissipates, and the pervasive feeling that accompanies it loses in intensity until it disappears completely, making room for Friday. Friday is not ideal for concentration. It feels like a little vacation each week, a day volatile as a gas and comforting as homemade mashed potatoes. It's difficult to work on a Friday, even when I'm in the thick of a manuscript. If only I could find a satisfying translation for the title of the novel, Waiting for the Day to Come. Fortunately, Friday brings me good luck because of its color, green. It's not just a superstition. There's real evidence to back this up. Whenever I've really needed it, I've looked for green around me in a nearby object or in a landscape. If I find it, I know that things will end well. The day when I gave birth to my son, I was terrified. My husband met me at the hospital wearing a green t-shirt, and the birth went smoothly. When we first visited the house that would become ours, the green shutters confirmed that we were making the right decision. When we had an appointment to sign the paperwork for our house, the notary's green door, which I noticed only upon leaving, would have reassured me that my husband was already inside. I had a happy childhood, and I'm convinced that it's in part thanks to my mother's green eyes. Green can sometimes reach me in an indirect way, too. The night when I met my husband, the English band playing was called the Green Peas. I look out the window. The lawn looks extra green today because of the dew, this omnipresent green that brings me luck more than any other color. Maybe there's a scientific explanation. After some research on the internet, I discover that its place on the color spectrum corresponds to the wavelength 525 nanometers. Of course. I grew up at number 52 on Rue Victor Bache, and I was born in Doubs, department 25. 525. Sometimes the best explanations are the most rational ones. I've always seen days by their color. It's how I locate myself in time. When I have a meeting somewhere, I rarely need to write it down. My schedule appears before my eyes in the form of a colored grid. When I was little, I thought it was the same for everyone. I figured that the nuances of colors might have been different for some people, but that each person had their own mental rainbow. When I was in primary school, I realized, rather painfully actually, that this was not the case. I said yellow instead of Thursday when referring to the school trip I was awaiting impatiently. The teacher laughed at my mistake, and when she corrected me, I tried to explain that in any case, it was the same thing. I was convinced that Thursday was yellow for everyone. Laughs broke out among the rows of desks. I was humiliated when the teacher told me in front of the whole class that mixing up colors and days of the week at 7 years old was no laughing matter. Did I want to go back to my little friends in kindergarten? Taking my attempt at explanation for insolence, she reprimanded me. For weeks, my classmates called me a witch and a liar and said that I was strange. It wasn't until much later that I realized this colored perception of time also influenced my sight. It took me a long time to figure out, even though certain clues should have made it obvious. The tint of a lipstick would seem sultry and sensual on a Thursday night, but bland and insipid on a Sunday morning. There are certain dresses I wear only on Wednesday, others only on Friday. On Tuesday, the day that corresponds to black, I am more sensitive to shadows and chiaroscuro. It feels like living in a Caravaggio painting, and I seriously wonder whether the Italian artist painted all his canvases on a Tuesday. And then there was that exhibition dedicated to the painter David Hockney 10 years ago. In awe, I went back again the next day, but the paintings seemed different to me than they had the day before. I still liked them, but something had changed. I had such a hard time believing my eyes that I went to ask at the front desk whether they had changed the lighting that day. That was when I understood. Now I know that, on Monday, blue objects appear with more intensity in my field of vision, and on Wednesday it's orange things. Tuesday, I searched high and low for my yellow notebook, the one containing the scientific vocabulary for my translations, in vain. Thursday, I found the notebook on the entryway table. No surprise, it took until the yellow day for that yellow object to appear. It's as though each day of the week places a filter in front of my eyes, a film roll with its own grain or a certain sensitivity to light. Each morning, my entire landscape shifts in hue. I've been working for several hours on my translation and am concentrating on one of the chapters when the title appears to me suddenly. The weight, the movement, the imminence, the dawn, the ellipsis, the poetry. It checks all the boxes. Waiting for the day to come. En attendant le jour qui paraîtra bientôt.